Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I'm Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, 2 weeks in a row, red wine.
Another Cabernet Sauvignon. This one is called Old Soul. And, I don't know if it really matches specifically to anything that we're going to be talking about, but I guess you could make a stretch and say that I'm sort of an old soul because I remember the original Charlie's Angels television series that premiered in 1976.
And I'm sure you're all the better for it. I do not. I was too young for that, but I do remember the 2000 version with Diaz, Barrymore, and Lou, and I hated everything about it. It wasn't funny, it wasn't fun, and I believed they were making fun of themselves. It just left a bad taste in my mouth. I did not see the 2003 sequel, Charlie's Angels: Full Throttle.
My memory is so bad right now that I cannot recall which of those I saw, or if I saw both the 2000 and the 2003 versions. I have a vague recollection of those three particular actresses, so I must have seen one or the other, but they obviously were quite forgettable, whereas the series that ran from 1976 to 1981 was really... It was my era of TV viewing, and so I did have an affinity for the original Charlie's Angels.
You told me earlier this week the new Charlie's Angels is not a reboot. They're not restarting it. It's a continuation. It's a continuation of the Charlie's Angels story, because now they're more than just Charlie, Bosley, and three girls. They're a multinational global corporation with a Charlie, a whole bunch of Bosleys, and even more Angels.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if I would. Elizabeth Banks, the writer director, wants it to be viewed as this continuation, a rebranding. Whether or not it pulls that off in its entirety is up for debate. But yeah, the idea is that, you know, where is the Charles Townsend agency 40 years hence? You know, it's grown. Like any other business that survives will have grown, and it has expanded globally and just sort of had to be contemporary in its operations and in its personnel.
You mentioned writer, director, producer, star Elizabeth Banks, who's never directed a film she did not want to cast herself in. She plays one of the Bosleys now, and sorry about that. That just came out of nowhere. And threw me for a whole loop. This, what I noticed right off the bat is this movie takes itself seriously. It's funny at points. It's got its one-liners. It's got zingers. It's even got a zany character in Sabina, played by Kristen Stewart. But they're true to themselves. They believe in who they are and what they do, whereas the last iteration did not. And they were just along for the quirky booty shaking and terrible jokes. What I wanted to ask you is I want to give you an Elizabeth Banks quote.
Okay.
People have to buy tickets to this movie.
No.
This movie has to make money. If this movie doesn't make money, it reinforces a stereotype in Hollywood that men don't go see women do action movies.
This is the wrong week to make that claim, because no matter how you slice it, there are way too many other better things to see. So while this movie might be perfectly okay, you know, as in it doesn't suck, it's not a must-see. And so to put that burden on female and male moviegoers, I think is unfair, especially at this time of year.
Now, she equivocated. I mean, men will go see Wonder Woman and Captain Marvel because those are comic book movies and they technically involve other characters in the canon. This is not a comic book movie. It's based off of a TV serial. It's not setting up any other characters like Justice League. And it's already bombing at the box office. It's going to lose heartily to Ford v. Ferrari.
As it should.
But the one choice they made, which is reason it's not going to hurt so much, is they made it on the cheap. It's a low budget. Another question for you, since it's currently tanking and has a relatively low budget, should have Columbia Pictures, Sony Pictures, Elizabeth Banks, shelled out for some actual star power. Yes, Kristen Stewart is a star. People will go see it because Kristen Stewart is in it. However, she's the only angel that anybody knows. I know Naomi Scott was Jasmine earlier this year, but people still don't really know who she is, and no one knows who the third angel is, Jane.
Well, it's her breakout. For Jane, it's her breakout role.
Have they invested in some star power?
I don't think it would have mattered this particular week. You could have pretty much put out, I think, the same movie with perhaps a little more star power. But again, there's just too much other better stuff to see. And so, no, I think it's fine. You're trying to set up what could potentially carry on through future iterations. And so you can't always rely on heavy duty star power to be available for anything that would continue into the future. It's really setting up this idea of what this new Charlie's Angels world universe would look like. And so you could interchange now all these different angels, very much like the series did. I mean, even though in most people's minds, nobody knew who the three actresses were who became the original Charlie's Angels. But they're still the ones that you're going to be able to name today, you know, with Farrah Fawcett and Jacqueline Smith, who does have a cameo in this film, and Kate Jackson. But there were many other angels that then were sort of came and went throughout the rest of those four, for the following four seasons. So I don't think you have to say that it would have required more star power. I don't think that would have made any difference.
This is kind of a case of ho-hum, seen it before. There's a mystery, there's a whodunit, there's a who's the bad guy behind the curtain sort of thing. But I really think the plot is beside the point here. It's
definitely
there's a plot. They're going from A to B to C in a linear plot fashion. But I don't even want to talk about it just because it doesn't really mean anything. I'm most interested in Kristen Stewart, who has baggage. People either really love her or they just don't care for her because they didn't care for the Twilight series, or they don't like her arty pictures lately, or they don't like how she's been all over the tabloids. It was very brave, I think, to cast her, and I think she slam dunks it. I think she's so good. She's actually by far the best casting, the best performance in the film.
She is. I mean, she makes this movie without a doubt. She shows that she's very funny, you know, but in her sort of dry wit sort of way, very wry humor, and she nails it. But she has shown, I mean, she's very versatile. She's shown that to be able to go from Twilight to Clouds of Sils Maria, you know, that takes some versatility. And so I think if nothing else, this film just shows that she sort of deserves to be looked at as the total package as an actress, and sort of you have to kind of let the tabloid stuff go by the wayside. And so again, this movie, I think it has like a 60-61% on Rotten Tomatoes, so it's not tanking in that respect. You know, that's respectable. I think six out of ten is
kind of a fresh tomato.
It is. 6 out of 10 is not such a bad thing for this movie. And so it pays homage to the continuation, to the originals, but also sets up the potential for something in the future. And it's not bad, but it just is not a current must-see.
No, it's definitely not a must-see. But I think if you're with your girls, and the intended audience is girls, even though men will like it just fine. I liked it just fine. But there's a montage at the beginning of, you know, just girls, random girls doing things. It's just showing, it's Banks showing you girls can do anything. It's just a montage. So it's really for the ladies on a Saturday night sneaking in a bottle of rosé into the theater and having a good time and wearing impractical shoes. It's girl power.
Yeah, it is. Although I would argue that the next movie we're going to talk about should draw the women as well.
I did not see our next film. You did at the Middleburg Film Festival, and I want to kick it off with another question. Ford v. Ferrari, and it concerns a race that happened in real life, and some people, not all people, will know the result. So my question is, sometimes, if I know the end of a story, if I already know the end of a film, and I believe I know the characters well enough, I have no desire to see the film. Is that the case here?
No, not at all, because this is not about the race itself entirely. This is more about the friendship between the characters played by two phenomenal actors, Matt Damon and Christian Bale. You can't go wrong. It is a chick flick wrapped in a testosterone-fueled sports movie.
You don't get a lot of those.
You don't. And when they happen, they appeal to a large group of people. And so this was a story I was not familiar with. But I do think that because of the way the cinematography, the way it's shot, and the interaction between these characters, I think you can enjoy it on so many different levels, whether you are a motorsports fan or just a fan of a good sports movie and a fan of a good sort of family and friendship drama.
Who do we like better, Matt Damon or Christian Bale?
They are totally, I think, well matched. And that's what makes this work. Is it here you've got two Academy Award winners who are working so well off of each other and not against each other at all. There is a perfectly good, strong reason for the co-billing. I think the title and seeing the two of them, though, in on the poster, I think people are almost driven away by the title, Ford versus Ferrari. Non-car people.
There's nothing chick flick about that.
No. And the thing is, it's not like one of them plays Ford and one of them plays Ferrari. If I had to think about it, I'd think that, oh, somebody's playing Henry Ford and somebody's playing Enzo Ferrari. That's not the case. They actually are playing two race car legends who are friends. And you've got Matt Damon playing this guy, Carroll Shelby, who did, in fact, win the 24 Hours at Le Mans in the late 50s. But then he had a heart condition that precluded him from continuing to race. So he ended up reinventing himself and becoming a car designer and salesman. And was recruited by Henry Ford II, I believe, played by Tracy Letts, excellent performance by him as well, to then say, hey, I want you to help Ford design a car that's just as sexy and powerful and sleek as a Ferrari car. And I want you to be able to put this car up against Ferrari in the 1966 Le Mans race and at least make a good showing and preferably beat Ferrari.
It's a steep ask.
It was almost a comical ask at the time. And so Carroll Shelby at the time said, fine, I'm going to do this. He helps them build this car and says, but I'm not moving forward unless you agree to let Ken Miles actually get in the car and drive this thing. And so Ken Miles was a British-born, bit of a hothead who corporate wonks did not particularly care for, but they became a package deal, and that's sort of what this film is about. And the two of them are just so really good together to watch.
Liked it better than Charlie's Angels?
Absolutely. I mean, this one has all the ingredients for what would be that award season crowd pleaser. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens, because it's just that all around feel good, interesting film.
Right on. Our next film is only in theaters for a limited time because it's a Netflix film and it will be available for streaming in just a couple weeks. We're talking about Noah Baumbach's Marriage Story, starring Adam Driver and Scarlett Johansson. When I walked out of this film, all I could think of was, I never, ever, ever, ever want to get divorced. It's an anti-divorce movie, even though it's about divorce. What they think will be an amicable split becomes much tougher when they become bi-coastal. One of them has to kind of fight to see his kid. Lawyers get involved, specifically Laura Dern and Alan Alda and Ray Liotta, who I think is very unforgettable, even though Dern's getting a lot of press.
And Alda is as well.
What I wanted to ask you is, from the outside, from the initial take, it's an even film. There's his story, there's her story. You get both sides. You probably get a little bit more of him because there's a lot of anguish as he tries to find ways to hang out with his child. But first of all, does Baumbach, do you think the director takes sides?
I'm not sure. I think if he does, he's taking the side slightly more of Adam Driver's character.
Both of them are good in our eyes and both of them make mistakes.
Yeah, but there's a sympathy factor that falls with the guy.
That's my second question. Where do the audience's sympathies lie?
I think there's an idea. Everyone will recognize both characters. They will identify with what's going on. It sort of ebbs and flows with whether or not you're angry at one or the other of them about their demeanor or their choices. And it's really, I think what makes it so raw and authentic is that nobody's totally in the right and nobody's totally in the wrong. And the only thing that I think everyone can agree on is, oh my gosh, once the lawyers, high-powered, high-cost lawyers get in the mix, boy, do things take a turn. And so it's, but it's typical. Noah Baumbach always gets into these family dynamic stories. I mean, I remember, I think it was a year or two ago with the Meyerowitz stories. Yeah. And this takes, I think, a very similar tone.
It's very, when we saw an interview, we saw him in person during the Q&A after the film. And somebody said, this feels like a sequel, a loose sequel to The Squid and the Whale, another family film about divorce.
Right. And it's apparently, some people are saying it's somewhat autobiographical.
It is. His parents did divorce.
But also Baumbach's relationship.
Baumbach divorced.
Baumbach's divorce, his relationship with Jennifer Jason Leigh. And so, who knows? I mean, if you know, they say write what you know. And so it's very possible that that he is channeling some of his emotions about who's right and who's wrong. But it goes beyond that. It really kind of touches on how the breakup, the dissolution of this marriage, even just kind of subtly impacts everyone else around them, their friends, their coworkers, their kid, and in-laws. And so, you know, it's very realistic. Whether or not people really want to see realistic,
well, it's tough because technically, this is 2019's Kramer versus Kramer. We've seen this before with Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep. I think this is a lot better than Kramer versus Kramer.
Oh, I don't think so. It's different. I think it's slightly different.
Driver, even they're both getting noticed.
Scarlett Johansson.
They're both getting talk. Mm-hmm. Driver's getting ridiculous talk. He's got a scene in this film that is pure Oscar bait. Someone said he is our generation's best yeller. You know, he's yelled as Kylo Ren. He's yelled in like four other films. And here he gets a scene where he gets to lose it. He doesn't even become a human being anymore. It's that sort of scene, which might just maybe give him the edge over Johansson, because she didn't have a scene like that.
No, Scarlett Johansson just kind of is there in a much more subdued way. I think our focus, our attention throughout this film is on Adam Driver's character as the father who is struggling to be able to maintain this relationship with his son long distance when Scarlett Johansson's character basically picks up and moves across the country to work on a TV pilot. And so it really is, your focus is on what the sacrifices that you feel that the Driver's character is making versus the sacrifices or the choices that she's making. But again, it ebbs and flows so that at a certain point you kind of feel a little more empathy and sympathy really towards both of them equally, because you realize that it's just sad. It's sad that that their relationship, which started as a very fundamentally strong personal and professional relationship, just evaporated and just broke apart. And so I think anybody who's been through that can identify. You talked about for Charlie's Angels, the gals just kind of grabbing some wine and getting together to watch that one. To me, this is one you're almost better off waiting to watch when it streams with a bottle of wine or something harder.
Is it possible? Will the gender split? Will the guys identify with Adam Driver going, yeah, that's it. Why is she moving way over there and taking the kid? I know he's done some stuff, but come on. And will the ladies identify with Johansson going, hey, look what he did. You go, girl. Take charge of your life. Don't be second fiddle. Will the genders argue?
I don't think so. Whether they argue, I think it will be arguing both sides of the coin. So depending on what their own personal experiences might have involved, is sort of, I think, what they're going to bring to the table. I don't think there'd be a gender split, because I absolutely saw, you know, I felt compassion just as much for Adam Driver's character as for Scarlett Johansson's. So I found myself kind of like the mother-in-law in this film, where she was really torn because she loved her son-in-law and she loves her daughter.
Who plays the mother-in-law?
Oh, I can't remember.
I was setting you up. It's Julie Haggerty.
Julie Haggerty.
Of Airplane fame.
Oh, right. Yes. Yeah. And she, that's right. I was trying to figure out where I remembered her from. But she's very funny, and but also has a very relatable role in this. So, yeah, I don't think anyone will necessarily take sides. I, though, would argue that I think still in my mind, Kramer versus Kramer. And this one packs somewhat of a gut punch, but I remember just bawling my eyes out during Kramer versus Kramer.
I'm shocked. What do you mean? I think Marriage Story packs the bigger gut punch. It annihilated my solar plexus. I was hurting after this film.
I think it takes a slightly different approach. It's a quieter gut punch. I think the Kramer versus Kramer
it's better screenplay too.
Just again different, but certainly it is. I think the current version. I think it's anyone who remembers Kramer versus Kramer and sort of could identify or relate or watch that movie and is curious about sort of revisiting that theme. This one is as close as you're going to get. And it is. It's an excellent screenplay, but I just, this is one that almost feels like, yeah, it's better to watch it at home streaming it than to go into a theater for it. Because it's a tough watch.
We're just going to disagree on that.
Okay.
Speaking of Adam Driver, he's pulling double duty this week. Not only is he in a Netflix film, he's in an Amazon studio film called The Report. And it's not a documentary, but it's very nonfiction because it's concerns an actual report that a guy named Daniel J. Jones sat down and wrote for the Senate Intelligence Committee, and it was on the CIA's detention and interrogation program. It was all over the news when the CIA got busted, burning, shredding the tapes that they took of them interrogating Al-Qaeda prisoners, Taliban prisoners, of the hunt for bin Laden, where's the next attack, you know, after 9/11. They burned the evidence of those interrogations. Why? Senator Dianne Feinstein, played by Annette Bening, wanted to know why they did that, and she told Jones to go and figure it out. For 5 years, he went and figured it out, and he wrote a 6,700-page report of only 525 pages were ever declassified and released. This is the movie about that. It's actually about that process. It's not about necessarily what's in the report, even though that's a big part of it. We have flashback scenes of torture, of why they believe they had to go that route, of the cover-up. But it's actually about Daniel Jones, the human being, saying, okay, I'll go take the long weekend and write this report. And what it does to him as a human being over the 5 years, and the bureaucracy, which is get dry at times, of him sitting around tables arguing of why don't you want the truth? What are you afraid of? If you say it worked, and you know, then why do you have to do it 183 times? I enjoyed the film. I didn't love it. I liked it. It can get dry, but I think it's about a very important issue.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, it's about torture and the fact that the Bush administration at the time was sort of denying that these enhanced interrogation techniques amounted to torture. And what this report and what Jones found out was that this was freaking torture. And there was no credible intel that really came out of any of this. And I found the most disturbing part of it was this realization that I think it was these psychologists who ended up getting a contract with the government, making gazillions of dollars, sort of putting forth these behavioral and torture ideas that were then instituted that amounted to nothing other than getting these psychologists a boatload of money. And it just produced no credible intelligence or actionable intelligence because the people that were being tortured, it's very possible they really didn't know anything more than what they were saying. And to me, this was I call it a Zero Dark 30 inside the Beltway. So you're right. It's the political side of what was going on. You know, everyone saw like the Abu Ghraib pictures and things like that. But this is a bureaucracy story that's told in as good a way as a bureaucracy story can be told. It's a very important story, but unfortunately, it's also another one of those preaching to the choir kind of films, and the people who really, really need to see it will not. But it's an interesting film for those who might be on the fence about whether torture or enhanced interrogation techniques can really produce anything actionable and in the interest of national security. It's a tough debate, and I think this film touches on that. Adam Driver is just, you know, he shows, and within, we saw the two films within 24 hours, and he could play both these roles so well. And so, it's definitely Adam Driver's year, but how you choose whether one performance is necessarily stronger than the other, probably have to go with Marriage Story, but only because of the nature of the gut-wrenching nature of one film over the other. So yeah, I mean, this was one of those true stories that I don't think I was really aware of. So I was happy to have seen it, but not necessarily, again, not sure that it's one of those ones that people would find to be a must-see in the theater right now.
It's not a tough choice. Adam Driver's much stronger performance is Marriage Story. This is a regular performance. It's good, mm-hmm. but for Adam Driver, it's a regular performance.
Right.
I found this to be a frustrating film. The director, Scott Z. Burns, proved his point. I believe he showed us and will convince the audience that torture doesn't work. Everything they got out of these guys was... they either already had, or it was a lie. They start with a real-life interview from Dick Cheney, who alludes and smirks to the fact, mm-hmm. yeah, we're going to go get him, and oh, if you only knew what we were going to do to him. Mm-hmm. And at the end, they show the speech on the Senate floor by John McCain, when the report, portions of the report was released, he's trying to explain to, like, Mitch McConnell, who's standing right next to him, torture does not work. And, half the electorate doesn't care, and they don't want to hear the truth. Maybe they wanted revenge at the time. Who cares if you get anything out of it or not? Just go torture them anyway. And this is why none of these guys are ever prosecuted, because torture doesn't hold up in a court of law. And just the easy, easy questions it asks that nobody can answer. If it works, why did you have to do it 183 times on the same guy? If it's standard procedure, why did you cover it up?
Right.
The easiest questions ever, and they're hard because they know they did wrong. And that's why it's so frustrating that only people like us, the choir, are going to see this movie.
Yeah. And it is frustrating also in that it reminded me, it felt a little bit like watching Vice last year, because I was like, do I really need a reminder? Do I need to see more with all the stuff that we're having to witness on a day-to-day basis in the current political climate? It's really hard to then go and watch a film that... that just sort of takes us even deeper into that hole. And so it's a preaching to the choir film, but I do think that that it's an important story that is definitely worth seeing and telling.
The documentary we saw this week also touches on the current climate, especially towards the end. We saw Scandalous, the untold story of the National Enquirer. I remember when the National Enquirer was huge. This is after it was all about traffic accidents, oddballs, and UFOs. I mean, when it was really about celebrities, mainly like Oprah and OJ and Princess Diana and John Benet. Mm-hmm. And they take us to the history. We get the founder, the mafia guy, Generoso Pope Jr. He's the one who really took the Enquirer and put it inside supermarkets. That was his claim to fame. He figured, where do 100 million people have to go every week and get stuck? The supermarket line, which is how the National Enquirer took off and became the best-selling paper in the United States. It was the first form of clickbait, if you will. They had mm-hmm. these sensational headlines. And then we get a lot of the old reporting staff. This is why I really wanted you to see this movie. The reporters are, I knew this was bad ethics. I knew I was going to get laughed at. But the money they were paying me was triple of if I would have worked for the Times or the Post. And what it felt like is that they were giving themselves a get-out-of-jail-free card. They were making it sound a little bit, or a lot better than it actually was. I think they were giving themselves a pass.
In a way, but I also recognize that they were saying that, look, you've got some really good journalists, that are working on these stories. There were kernels of truth to these stories, and they did break some stories, and they took things a step further than the mainstream media might have, because they did have an open checkbook. And they're really talking about what a difference it makes that you're still getting these real photos. I don't think I'd remember just what a splash it made. They had a photo of Elvis Presley in his coffin, and to hear exactly how they ended up getting that picture.
It's presented as a comedy, by the way.
It was weird. But to realize, they talked about how people who were very close to these celebrities were the ones to betray them. That, look, we are just doing our job. We got money to do it. We operated like every other newsroom. The mainstream media people were really just jealous because we were getting some stuff that they weren't, and because we were able to pay for information.
Are you on their side?
No, but I've heard it. I understand what the reporters, like what their efforts to...
You're not supposed to pay for information.
No, not true journalism, you don't. So you have to make the separation. But this is, to me, they were the TMZ of print. So TMZ took that same kind of idea, and they've managed to convert it into a television thing. They pay. They have sources that are paid to leak information from the courts and from, you know, police blotters, and letting them know when somebody's going to be sneaking out of jail at the middle of the night. And so this really was the precursor to reality television, I think, because what they are saying is, look, we're giving people what they're asking for. Whether that's right or wrong is for other people to debate, but the proof was in the dollars. And if people stopped buying the rag, they would have had to change their modus of operation. But people did not stop buying. They fed right into it. The other thing that was fascinating, though, is they do expose the squelching of stories that went on and were not okay with it. That they talked about how they had the Bill Cosby story way early on, but how the editors struck deals with folks like Bob Hope, Bill Cosby, Donald Trump to catch and kill stories. You pay somebody for their story and then you squelch it. You kill it, you bury it, and then they stay friends with these people in power. The stuff about Donald Trump, to hear him calling into the Inquirer, providing tips about Donald Trump to get him in this paper, was fascinating to actually hear that again, to hear on tape where it's Donald Trump calling in, pretending to be somebody close to Donald Trump who's providing this tip. So I can't defend it. It's it will make any journalist really just make their blood boil, make them squirm. It's a combination of envy about the resources and being able to spend money, and the disgust as to this is not what journalism is supposed to be. This is not, journalists need to have a certain level of integrity. You don't pay for information. So I don't know. I just while I hate the argument that they were making, I also have heard it before. I heard it when people from, CNN went to Fox and they had to defend why. And often it was because the paycheck was much bigger and the job they were doing felt to them similar, that I can do the same job and make a heck of a lot more money over here, so I'm going to take this job instead.
I learned the National Enquirer actually committed harm. They had Bob Hope's casting couch operation. They had Bill Cosby early. I mean, year one or two of the Huxtables. They had him so early. How many more victims did they help become actual victims because they let him go?
Well, and Schwarzenegger, there was a whole part of them striking a deal with him when he was, making his rise in politics. So it was the most distressing part, but that was not the everyday reporters. That was the decision of management and the ownership.
Yes, his name's Steve Koz, by the way, if you want to put a name to that.
and the original Pope Jr. didn't help.
Compare this to really the other journalist documentary that we saw this year, to Mike Wallace's here. Maybe an actual, there was a bit of how much show business is in this famous newsman, Mike Wallace, but can you compare the two, and does one come off better than the other?
I think journalists will be more interested in seeing the Mike Wallace story because they'll feel better about journalism seeing that one. This one, I don't think many journalists will actually in the end really care to see it because it's a very bitter pill to swallow.
I think the Mike Wallace story is actually just a better made film too. Mm-hmm. This is a bit more slapdash. It just starts. I thought the beginning was so choppy. It just, okay, here we are. National Enquirer was formed in 1953.
No, it's not a great documentary, and I think it's a CNN Films documentary, and so it will probably show up in the next year on CNN. So again, it's not one that I would encourage anyone to run out and see. If you have any interest in salacious journalism, checkbook journalism, or how not to tell stories, then you might want to catch this one. But I wouldn't pay to see it in the same way I wouldn't pay for information for a story.
All right. Quick question before we wrap up this episode. Netflix is making Beverly Hills Cop 4. Are you on for the ride?
Is Eddie Murphy in it?
Yes.
Is Judge Reinhold in it?
Unknown.
Well, see, I think you tweeted out earlier this week that you got to have Judge Reinhold.
You have to have Judge Reinhold and Bronson Pinchot.
Absolutely. If you can throw Bronson Pinchot and Judge Reinhold in there, then I'm on board for another Beverly Hills
That's
Cop.
A big coup for Netflix because, people still really love Eddie Murphy. He's still a draw. And that would be a huge get for
them. After Dolomite, I think we'll be watching him again.
Quick wrap up. Charlie's Angels is a lot better than I thought what it was going to be. Kristen Stewart's funny.
It's better than I thought it was going to be, but it's not a movie that I would send you to this particular week.
Ford versus Ferrari.
That's the movie I would send you to this particular week.
I would send you to Marriage Story. I think Marriage Story is the best film this week.
That's because you didn't see Ford versus Ferrari.
Touche. The report is the Eat Your Vegetables movie.
It is. I want to send you to it, but I can understand it if you take a pass and wait until after the holiday season.
Scandalous: The Untold Story of the National Enquirer. It just made me mad. It's just another, what is wrong with the world?
Exactly. It made me mad. It made me depressed about the state of journalism and the world, and also about the lowest common denominator that the world just feeds into. And I thought that was the saddest point of all.
All right. Well, and it's not you listeners. It's everybody else.
That's right.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl. Take care.